Welcome back, my friends, to AA Recovery Interviews. I'm your host, Howard L., and I'm an alcoholic. Sober since January 1st, 1988, one day at a time. I'm grateful you've joined us. AA Recovery Interviews is the podcast where Alcoholics Anonymous members from around the world share their extraordinary stories of experience, strength, and hope. There are over 140 interviews in this podcast series, all of which you can enjoy on the AARecoveryInterviews.com website and on all podcast apps. With nearly 20 years of sobriety, my guest, John M., relapsed after an extended period of good fortune had convinced him that he was cured. The admitted alcoholism that had brought John to the program at age 24 had been arrested for years through his hard work in AA. And initially, it helped him survive deployment to Iraq in the early 1990s and a horrible helicopter crash in Somalia that killed four fellow Marines and left John badly injured. During subsequent years, John brought his experience and perspective gained in AA to help found one of the largest service agencies for wounded veterans. During the years he spent building that organization, John also got married and had a few kids. But though he was active in AA for many of those early years, John's success sidetracked him into believing he was running the show and didn't really need the program. John's alcoholism conspired with his feeling of being cured such that his meetings and program work trailed off years before his slip. As sobriety steadily lost its priority, John started drinking again. In short order, things got really bad. Ultimately, John's demise was fueled by a divorce, deaths in his family, and business reversals. Depression and serious PTSD further fed the fire, and John seriously felt suicide would be the only way out. But on a day in early 2012, in a moment of clarity, the grace of God prevailed. John returned to AA as a badly beaten man, yet the loving arms of Alcoholics Anonymous still embraced him the minute he stepped through the wide-open doors of his local AA club. John's extraordinary story speaks to the power and possibilities available to everyone in Alcoholics Anonymous. His active daily involvement in the program harkens back to his first period of sobriety before the insidious nature of the disease moved sobriety to the bottom of his priority list. He is careful to stay always in the middle of the program through service work, sponsorship, prayer, and daily work on the steps. I feel like John's story will touch your heart, but also rattle the vestiges of whatever lies your disease offers you during times of tragedy and triumph, good times and bad times, and any other day we let up on our program of vigorous action. So I invite you to sit back for the next 75 minutes and be moved by the words of my close friend and AA brother, John M.
My name's John. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, John. That's the typical response that you hear in AA rooms around the world. First of all, I want to really thank you for doing the interview this evening. You and I just came out of a really terrific meeting, but more important than that, you picked up your 12-year chip tonight because today is your birthday.
February 19th, 2012, Monday.
Okay, it was Monday. We hand out chips weekly, so you were here to do that. Congratulations.
Thank you, Howard.
12 years. I think I was around when you came back in, but you had actually had a previous sobriety period, did you not?
I did, Howard. I was sober for just that 20 years and went back out in 2010 and stayed out there for a couple of years. Mm. So I'm here to report that it's a progressive disease that gets worse over time. Unfortunately, I had to learn that the hard way.
Yours is one of the most powerful stories I know in AA, and there's another friend of ours, Joe P., who has a similar story. He was sober for 25 years and slipped and went out, and now he's got...
I think he's got about 14. Joe is a guy who sought me out when we first got sober to tell me that he shared the same story, and Joe's been a great inspiration for me because he's got obviously a little bit more time than I do now, but he's been a big help in my sobriety and just somebody else who knows not just the difficulty of going out, but the shame in coming back in, or at least the perceived shame when you come back in.
When you were within that 20-year period, Were you active in AA the whole time?
You know, it's funny. Today I picked up my 12-year chip, and I know that that's the last chip I ever picked up in AA when I was in my first period of sobriety.
Interesting. So you were sober for 12 years doing the entire program, and then somewhere along the way that trailed off?
Yeah, you know, kids came, and to be honest with you, Howard, I got really successful in my own life, in my professional life. I became kind of a big shot, and, you know, at some point in time, I kind of figured out, or I kind of figured that I did it myself, and that it was my power that got it done.
So God wasn't in that equation, was he?
He wasn't, and that is something that when you look back, you see. You don't necessarily, you rarely see it when you're in it, but the alcoholic mind is tricky that way. Yeah. You know, it wants us isolated and away from the mothership, untreated. That's what it wants.
Did you have any inclination when you were sober during that period of time, as you were watching other people who were slipping, did you ever stop to consider the reasons why they slipped?
I did. But you know, Howard, I served in the military. I was a Marine. I was in one of the, you know, most storied Marine Corps units in our history. I just thought that I was a tough guy and it couldn't happen to me. I thought that I had beat that when I was a young man, and I didn't think it was going to get me. I thought that I had transcended all my difficulties through hard work and innovation and, you know, just being a what I thought was a generally smart guy who was just immature when he first got sober. You know, I just thought that I was a kind of a frat boy on steroids. You know, I got sober when I was 24 years old, and it's relatively young.
So you had all this training. You were self-reliant, all the Semper Fi things that we hear about the Marine Corps.
Going to meetings in the Marine Corps.
And while you were in the...
I was. I went to meetings on Navy ships. I went to meetings on the military installation. I went to meetings all over town with other Marines. Was very active when I was in the Corps.
Let's rewind a little bit, John, to how you got to AA the first time.
Yeah.
What kind of family did you grow up in? What was your family of origin like?
Yeah, you know, I grew up in a kind of a fine Irish Catholic home in, you know, outside of, you know, between Boston and Providence. And, you know, there wasn't much drinking in my home. My dad was kind of a working class guy. My dad was actually in the military, went in the reserves after the Vietnam War. And then when I was 18, he got called back into the military. That's part of the story. But I was a working class family. My dad used to come home, have a couple of beers, and put it down. You know, I never really saw alcoholism in my family, although there was kind of a quiet hush around the family gatherings about alcoholism, and that it ran relatively rampant through my extended family, you know, uncles, grandparent on one side, and my dad's dad. And so I know that it killed a couple of people that were in my extended family, but we were not close to my extended family. So I didn't see that much.
So all that was happening on the QT, you didn't know what was the cause at that point? Did anybody say your uncle died because he drank himself to death, or were you shielded from that as a child?
As a child, I was shielded from it. I told you my dad went to Washington, D.C. He went back in the Army, and he and my mom moved away, and they left me with my grandmother and grandfather for my senior year of high school. And, you know, I love my grandfather and grandmother, but I was kind of a free-range kid during that time, and I drank a lot. And I went to a concert. I went to see actually U2 in 1983 at Brown University, and it was $8 all you could drink, Pabst Blue Ribbon. I remember being 17 years old, and then we ended up in a fraternity house, and it was the first time I ever blacked out, Howard, and I went with some friends, and they lost me, and they left me in Providence, and I had passed out, and I guess I had vomited all over myself, and, you know, somebody found me in a bush and brought me home. My 15-year-old brother at the time didn't have a driver's license, and my grandmother sent him out to come try to find me.
Oh, wow.
Into the city of Providence, and he was driving around the city of Providence looking for his older brother without a driver's license. So, like I said, it was the first time I ever blacked out, and I woke up about noon the next day. It was a Saturday or Sunday, and my grandmother came downstairs, and she's visibly angry, and she said, "This runs through our family. I knew somebody would get it, and you've got it." And I was 17 years old. She said, "I could see it. I could see it in your eyes." And so that's the first time somebody planted in me that I had a problem, that I didn't drink like other people.
How long have you been drinking by that point? When did you start, and what was your behavior when you were drinking?
You know, I started somewhere 12, 13 years old. You know, I have a brother who's kind of my Irish twin. He's a year younger than me. And I remember him and I going to a friend's house, and he had an older brother, and, you know, he had a 12-pack of beer. And I remember the first time I drank, I said, "Whoa, this is great stuff, and I can't wait till I can get some more of this." You know, and I was 13 years old. And it was a quest from the time I was 13 till I was 24 years old to get as much of that product in my body as I absolutely could. It the physical feeling and the feeling of relief that I got. Mm-hmm. You know, I was a kid who had problems with attention in school. I was the kid that, I don't know if you remember this from when you went to school, when a kid would have an attention problem, they would put this kind of box, almost like a border on their desk, so they would pay attention and they couldn't see anything around them. It was almost a kind of a form of shaming you. And I remember that was the beginning of me feeling different. You know, I started to be like, I'm the only kid in this classroom that they're saying's got an issue and can't pay attention. And they put that box around my desk. And I think that was the first feeling of I'm different from the rest of these folks.
Did you take that feeling home and discuss it with your folks?
You know, my folks were very supportive. I don't know that I really had identified that. And back to this idea of kind of Irish Catholic East Coast, you know, this is the, you know, 70s. This kind of stuff didn't get talked about. People didn't talk
That's
about
true. ADHD hadn't even been identified at that point.
No. And so I was just a behavior problem.
Yeah.
And so that was the early days.
So when you drank in those days at 13, 14, let's say even for a few more years, was that to quell the feelings that you had that began with the being boxed up and the other shaming activities?
I think it started that way, Howard, but I think later on it was something that, to be honest with you, I thought I was pretty good at. You know, I could drink more than a lot of guys. I could hold my booze. It was kind of a manly thing to do. I saw other men that I knew and respected who could hold their liquor. I always looked up to the tough guys. I always looked up to the guys that could hold their booze and hold their own in a fight and do those kind of things. And I always wanted to be that kind of guy. And you know, so I power drank from the first time that I drank. I remember riding my Schwinn 10-speed with a backpack and a case of Michelob in it.
You know,
I wasn't even old enough to have a driver's license.
Mm-hmm.
We would go down to the reservoir by my high school and it was cold. And we would take that case of beer and put it in a trash bag and tie it to a tree. And, you know, when it got dark before the school dance, we'd go down there and drink a case of beer.
Mm.
You know, I'd crawl into those school dances. And, you know, it brought me, I had a kind of a reputation for a guy that could put it away. And, you know, I got a new group of friends.
I was curious what kind of crowd you ran with.
You know, I played sports all through school, but I was very involved in a lot of different organizations in school. And alcohol became my kind of Achilles heel early on. People looked at me and I had a lot of potential, but they saw early on that this guy drinks a little bit differently, and they stopped taking me seriously. And so I think my later life was a quest to be taken seriously after I quit drinking, because I felt for a period of time there, nobody took me seriously. I was just Johnny the party boy. I had proven for a reason that I was that guy.
So you had quite a reputation going on. You were building from the age of whenever it was you started drinking, you were determined to be the guy who could drink more, hold his liquor, and have a better time than everybody else.
Yeah, but on the sly, I was talking to people and saying, you know, is this normal? Is this okay? I remember going to college. I went to two schools, and the first school I went to was in North Carolina, and I chose a school that was run by Benedictine Catholic monks, kind of like this place, and had about 900 students. I thought, I'll go there because, you know, it's run by monks, so these guys are probably, they're probably chill, and they probably don't stand for this kind of behavior, and that'll straighten me out a little bit. Well, I guess the parents of 900 other people who were just like me decided that would be a good place for their kids, so every kid from New Jersey or New York City whose parents were Catholic and had a drinking problem decided to send them to this, you know, Benedictine school down in North Carolina. They just put us all together, and it accelerated very quickly.
Was that something that your folks, seeing a problem, decided to send you there, or was that your own?
That was my own doing.
So how were you feeling about yourself and your behavior that would become a revelation you needed to be where you could be protected from booze?
Yeah, I mean, I just knew that something was wrong with me, that I drank differently than other people. And I mean, I started blacking out very early. Like I said, I blacked out for the first time at 17, and I probably blacked out 10 times, 15 times a year between that time and the time I was 24 years old. I certainly did, probably did some permanent damage, you know, during that time. I was in a rollover accident at that school, you know, drunk driving accident we all walked away from. It became much more dangerous, you know, and then I transferred to another school, Howard, and joined a fraternity, and that was even worse. I mean, I'd have nights where I would have like multiple hospitalizations. You know, I would drink too much. I remember opening my chin up and having to get 10 stitches, and I wanted to go back to the party that we were at, and we were driving down this hill, and the guy wasn't going to take me to the party, so I jumped out the car and I reopened my stitches and had to go back to the hospital. And you know, I remember going home for spring break that year, and my dad said, "Sit down, asshole," and he had two hospital bills, and he said, "I knew about that you went to the hospital once. I called the hospital because I thought they double charged me, and I found out that you went twice in one night." So it was dangerous and getting more and more dangerous. And that's why at one point I decided that I'm going to go to an AA meeting and I'm going to say that they sent me from my psychology class to learn about alcoholism.
An interesting way to get to AA.
And so I went in and listened to my first meeting and those guys told my story.
Now, had you heard of AA before? Had you seen it in the popular culture around you to have an idea of what it might be about?
I did. I went to see a counselor when I was at Belmont Abbey, and the counselor said, "These are some of the resources if it ever gets to the point where you feel like it's out of control." And she told me about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think that's the first time that I heard of AA. And of course, a counselor in school planted the seed. I didn't know anybody that had gone to AA before. But when I was at Towson University in Baltimore, I heard that there was an AA meeting. I called to find out where the AA meeting was, and there was one close to campus at Greater Baltimore Medical Center. And I went to audit my first AA meeting in college. And then about 2 years later, after a kind of prodigious bender, I made my first call to AA in Alexandria, Virginia, and went to my first AA meeting.
So all this is going on, and you're aware of it. You're one of the few people I've interviewed who were acutely aware of what was causing their problems, acutely aware of how much and to what excess they were drinking, and even beyond that, aware that they needed help. And on your own, people around you weren't telling you this. You were telling yourself this.
Yeah, I mean, Howard, I'll tell you a funny story. I got into brown liquor when I was in college, and my fraternity, the Kappa Sigma fraternity at Towson University, had an open meeting, special session to discuss my use of brown liquor after a difficult weekend. Mm. And I was actually banned from drinking any brown liquor at any fraternity functions. So other people were noticing.
They were noticing.
Yeah, when you're going to the hospital a couple of times a night, you know, in one night, they start to notice. And so it wasn't just some quiet little secret. It was getting worse and worse. Yeah.
But it was self-evident, sounds like.
For sure.
Now, when you went to that meeting, you mentioned that they were telling your story.
Yeah.
Did that surprise you?
No, I knew. I knew there was a problem. I knew that I could not put it down. I could put it down for a couple of days, but I knew that the first one was never the only one. You know, I never was a guy. I don't remember ever having two beers, ever. For as long as I can remember drinking, I actually have thought about that many times, kind of a thought exercise. Have you ever had two beers? And I guess I have because I buy 240s.
You know? Yeah. You know, that's two beers, right?
Exactly. But the quantity was incredible from the very beginning.
Mm, mostly beer.
A lot of beer and then a lot of brown liquor, you know. Yeah, I liked bourbon a lot.
So you're in college, you're having all these issues with the fraternity, and you're getting into accidents. Were you in trouble with the law?
I had gotten arrested in my senior year. Howard, the funny thing is, I did ROTC all through school. I was at the top of my class in ROTC. Mm-hmm. I was not a great student, but I tried to keep it together, and I ended up getting a commission in the Army while I was still in my senior year of college. Mm-hmm.
That's hard to do, isn't it?
It is. And I played rugby, all 4 years of school. I was very active. I could kind of keep it together. Yeah. And I think that's where, you know, the family and other people weren't as alarmed, because there were things that I was doing that were deemed by others to be relatively successful.
So you were a functional alcoholic for all intents and purposes.
Yeah, I mean, at 24, it's hard to do, you know, I was 20, maybe 22 when I was in college. You know, I had done damage, but I hadn't done any real damage yet. I mean, I got arrested. That followed me the last arrest that I had 12 years ago this week.
Right.
You know, that followed me into this one. So I can't say that it didn't do any damage, because it did, you know, so...
So you got sober at what age the first time?
24.
So you were 24. So you had a period of maybe 6-7 years where you were drinking increasing amounts and you were getting into more trouble, but you were also managing to keep it together with school and your relationships?
Yeah. I mean, I kept girlfriends. I didn't have those type of issues. I had good relationships with my family.
So it's like, why stop drinking?
Yeah, but I got kicked out of school, and I moved home. I thought that I was going to get an active U.S. Army commission, and of course my grades and that arrest prevented me from getting a active Army commission.
And that was a DUI arrest that you had?
No, it was a drunk in public, but it was enough. So it kind of ruined my life plan, and... I stayed in the Army Reserve and went to work in a restaurant, actually managing a restaurant. I was actually recruited by a guy. I went initially to be a waiter and a bartender, you know, what you do when you drop out. And then I got recruited to be a restaurant manager, and I was a restaurant manager for a couple of years.
Uh-huh.
I loved it. It was really hard work, but the drinking increased because at the end of the night, we would drink. And, you know, in college, you learn to drink, and working in the restaurant, you learn to be a professional. Yeah. And so that really kind of was the beginning of the end for me.
So you were in the reserves this whole time?
I was. And I finished my commitment in the reserves. I actually went to Fort Benning, Georgia. I went to jump school. I went to the infantry officer basic course, which I drank through. Mm-hmm. And almost got kicked out of that for a drinking incident. On graduation day, I ended up in a seedy hotel in Columbus, Georgia with another buddy of mine, and we were late for the formation for our final graduation from Infantry Officer Basic School. So, you know, it just was rampant.
Sounds like you were really circling the drain at this point.
I was. And, you know, fortunately, I got sober. I got a great sponsor when I came in, who I'm still in contact with today. He's got over 40 years now, and is a high school principal. We were both young men. He was, you know, probably 27, 28. He was going to school to be a teacher and was an assistant football coach. And he and I used to drink at the same bar back at home, and he became my sponsor.
That's amazing. When you first went into AA to stop drinking, what were the final days leading up to that meeting and that sobriety date that lasted for 12 years?
I kept trying to quit and I couldn't. And every day I would wake up and I would say, I'm not going to drink today, for weeks and weeks on end.
Did you ever go to rehab?
I never did. Rehab wasn't a thing then.
Yeah.
I mean, this is 1989. So, you know, rehab just was not a thing. Never even heard of rehab. There wasn't anybody that I got sober with who ever went to rehab. It's a completely different world today than it was. You know that. You came in about the same time. Like you, my AA meetings were smoke-filled meetings in church basements. There was one club, two clubs. I went to the Independence Club in Annandale, Virginia, and then I went to another club in Georgetown. Went to a meeting called the Bagel Meeting, which was a kind of a famous meeting in Washington, D.C.
Interesting.
And just like here in Houston, I got a kind of a band of brothers and sisters that I ran around with that were young people in AA. I listened to a podcast that you did with Dan D, and he talks about his experience. He was younger than I was, and he talks about his experience as a young person in AA. And thank God for young people in AA. I think I would have found it exceedingly difficult if I didn't surround myself with young people who were trying to do the same thing as I would. And there's people peppered throughout my life for the last 30 or 40 years who have come into my life that I got sober with back then and I've met in my travels for business and like, hey, didn't we go to AA meetings together back in DC?
I'm trying to think when I first met you. That was during your initial period of sobriety?
No, you met me days after my arrest, which was that February 19th. So you would have met me 12 years ago, sometime around this time. It was this Sunday meeting. Somebody invited me to go to this meeting the week that I got sober the second time. And I met, it's when you were still kind of the greeter here.
Yeah, I would stand at the door, and I remember chatting with you, and I don't know if it came out in your share that night or whether somewhere along the way I learned that you had had 20 years of sobriety, and I didn't know very many people who, at that point, who had put together that kind of sobriety and then slipped and then made it back. So the question always is the guy who slipped after that much sobriety, what are his chances now? And I mean, I'm really grateful that you're still sober, but that must have been really difficult. But going back to the first period of sobriety, because I want to try and keep things straight, and that is, when you first went to your first meetings, were you looking for the similarities or the differences? What were your perception and how people related their own experiences in those meetings?
I was looking for people that, because I couldn't quit, I was looking to hear how people were doing it. And again, I go back to Jim S., who was my original sponsor, and Jim spent a lot of time on the first step and on the second step with me. And I remember, you know, clear as day that he would, whenever we would end a conversation, he would say, hey, buddy, how about we just stay sober for one more day? And that really got into my brain. Just, how about we stay sober for just one more day? And I'm like, at one point I just said, that's how they do this. They just do this thing one day at a time. And, you know, at that point I'd really struggled to ever get a day without drinking. And, you know, I'm like, okay, I haven't had a drink in 3 days. Okay, I haven't had a drink in 5 days. Holy moly, I haven't had a drink in a week. You know?
Were you going to AA and then drinking when you weren't there, or did you actually stop when you went and that's your original sobriety date?
Yeah, I stopped. That was the first AA meeting I went to was my final drink for 20 years.
For 20 years. So all that difficulty you had stopping What was there that made it possible for you to just stop at that
point? Well, I do remember going through some difficult times at home. I mean, I had the sweats. I had the shakes. I really struggled. I was living in the basement of a townhouse in Alexandria, Virginia, and remember waking up in the morning the first day that I quit, and my sheets were soaked. I'm like, what in the hell is going on here? I'm in the basement where it's normally cold, right? And I'm soaked, mm-hmm. and I hadn't gotten a sponsor at that point. It was a couple of weeks before I got a sponsor, but that guy, Jim, had come to me and said, who would later become my sponsor, said, hey, just call me every day, you know? And he ended up, I don't think I even ever asked him. He just became my sponsor. So to answer your original question, I was looking for the similarities. I was never looking for the differences because I wasn't trying I knew I had it, right? I mean, my grandmother looked at me at 17 years old and said, you got it. And I trusted her as much as, other than my parents, as anyone in the world. And if she saw it in my eye, that just stuck with me. You know, she was so earnest and so scared when she saw it. She loved me. I was the oldest grandson. And I knew she was scared.
You getting sober was something that you ultimately gave to her as a gift?
I think so. I don't know that she ever knew that I got sober. It wasn't something that I shared with her. You know, Howard, it's interesting. I've never been proud that I was a drunk, right? I've never been like, well, look at me. I achieved professional status, you know. That's never been a thing for me. I just feel blessed that God, you know, allowed me to stay sober for 20 years and the first time.
Well, as you're telling the story now, what I was curious was there seems to be some kind of innate humility with the realization that you can no longer drink and you've got to stop and I will become teachable. Yeah. I will do what I need to do. I will do the work. I will listen to the sponsor. Was that you in the early years?
Yeah, and it's funny because I'm defiant by nature. You know, I mean, I don't really like to be told what to do, which is interesting for somebody who's in the military. I really don't. I rebel against things that I think are stupid or that I don't want to do. I always have, still do today at 58 years old. But I know when somebody has my best interest at heart. And I knew that these people that I met in these meetings, they didn't have anything. I had no money. I had no fame. I had no house. I had nothing to give them. And they freely gave me love. You know, people that were my parents' age or older, my grandparents' age, they freely gave me their experience, shared their experience, strength, and hope with me and gave me their love. And I was just attracted to that. I just said, this is the greatest thing. And immediately kind of dug into helping other people, like I said, and running with an AA crowd.
We'll be right back. My friends, if you're enjoying AA Recovery Interviews, I invite you to check out my latest audiobook, Alcoholics Anonymous, the story of how more than 100 men have recovered from alcoholism. This is the word-for-word, cover-to-cover reading of the first edition of the Big Book, published in 1939. It's a relaxing yet meaningful and engaging way to listen to the Big Book anytime, any place. Have a free listen at Audible, iTunes, or Amazon. While you're there, search for my other audiobook, Lost Stories of the Big Book, 30 original stories from the first and or second editions missing from the third and fourth editions of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's also available from Amazon as a Kindle book or in paperback if you'd like to read along. You're going to love it. And we're back.
How many years would you say that you were doing the program the way it really needs to be done for someone to maintain their sobriety through the good times and bad times?
I'd say 8 or 9 years.
8 or 9 years. So you were doing the deal for a considerable period. Were you sponsoring men and doing service for the meetings? And
I ran the meeting on a naval ship on a deployment. You know, I did the deal. You know, I left the restaurant business because I felt like there's no way I'm going to stay sober in this business. I was a bartender for, you know, my first 6 months of sobriety. I said, this isn't going to work. Mm-hmm. And what happened was I'm very close to my brother and both my brothers, mm-hmm. but my Irish twin, and he had gone in the Army and joined the 101st Airborne. He became an Army officer, just like me. I had gotten out and he was getting ready to go to war. And I said, my little brother's not going to war without me. So I enlisted mm-hmm. in the Marine Corps.
How long had you been sober by this point?
I was sober a year.
A year.
When I joined.
Okay.
Which didn't go over well with my family. My parents were not happy because I went from being an officer to being an enlisted man. But I knew that I needed to get my life back on track and I needed some discipline. The AA was great and I stayed sober, but I discussed it with my sponsor. He thought it was a good idea and it brought me the discipline that I needed. At the time, I learned how to not be as defiant.
So your brother going in was the reason why you chose to go into the Marine Corps?
It was. It was that and the fact that I knew that it would be good for me. Inherently, I knew it would be good for me. And if there was a fight, I wanted to get in the fight. I was born that way. It's just who I am. And war's a terrible thing after having seen it, you know, a couple of times. But as a young man, I just did not want my brother to be able to tell those stories and I wouldn't be able to do them.
So you're sober a year and then you join the Marines. At what point did you get deployed?
I got deployed within 6 months.
6 months.
Yeah, I was in my unit for about 6 months and I went on what they called a WESPAC. And I don't know if I ever told you this, Howard, but about 4 months into that deployment, we were in the Gulf. We had gone into Kuwait and into northern Iraq. And then my unit was sent back to our ship. Things were heating up in Mogadishu, Somalia, mm-hmm. at the time. And my unit ended up going off of the Red Sea on the coast of Somalia to kind of be a show of force. On a Sunday morning, I was on a training mission. We were training to evacuate Americans who were in the embassy in Mogadishu. And the helicopter that I was riding, we were fast roping, which is kind of like sliding down a barber pole out the back of a helicopter, but it's a rope, you know, 40 feet above the ship, and you kind of slide down the rope and mm-hmm. practice, you know, evacuating people. That's mm-hmm. how you get onto the roof of the building. Well, when we were coming back, the helicopter that I was in had a massive mechanical malfunction and blew up in midair. Mm. And we ended up crashing into the ocean. And I lost four of my fellow Marines that day, and I was badly injured. And ended up being evacuated to the U.S., So, to make a very long story short, I stayed in for 3 more years. I ended up getting some great assignments. I went back to Somalia a year later mm-hmm. after I had recovered and drove the first American Humvee into the city. And so, going to meetings the entire time. You know, I had a program, but I've struggled with the events of that day the entire time.
PTSD.
Yeah, no, I struggle with PTSD to this day. The program really, really does help with that. There's a lot of things that the program helps with when it comes to PTSD. But I struggle with those kind of things. You know, I ended up getting selected to be an officer in the Marine Corps, and I went for my physical. And unfortunately, because of the injuries I had in the crash, I was not allowed to be an officer. So I made the decision, difficult decision, to get out.
So how long had you been in?
I was in for full 4 years. I wanted to make the 4 years. So I served between my Army time and my Marine Corps time. I'd served from 85 to 95. So 10 years of my life. So anyways, it was a difficult decision, but, stayed sober through that whole thing.
What level of understanding did you get when you brought that experience into the meetings and when you had the opportunity to talk in an open format in a meeting about your experience? Did you openly talk about it, or was that something that was talked about just to a sponsor or a few trusted friends? How did the groups respond to that horrific story that you just told me?
Yeah, I don't think I've ever shared that story in a meeting. It's certainly not the whole story. And not because I just didn't think it's appropriate. You know, I mean, we share our experience, strength, and hope as it relates to alcohol and alcoholism. And I thought that was something completely different. Now, certainly I've talked to sponsors and trusted friends like you about it. But, you know, here's the thing that I learned being 25 years old and almost losing my life. The big wake up was, this is going to end someday. You know, it became very up close and personal when you lose four friends, and the guy who was sleeping above you the night before in the rack above you is gone today. And you attend their memorial services, and, you know, very, very quickly that life is short. Nothing, what do they say in the program? Nothing makes you spiritual like fixing to be one. Yeah. or having that kind of experience where you're almost one, almost a spirit. And so, I think I surfed on that for a really long time, you know.
What had your spiritual life been like up to the point at which that accident occurred?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I was leading meetings on the ship. So I was very engaged in AA. I was very engaged in prayer and meditation and reading the book, and I was very engaged, and I think that really helped. I think it would have been much more difficult on me, and I would have had a harder time. I mean, there's guys that watched it was a horrific accident, and there's guys that watched that crash that get 100% for PTSD because they watched it, you know, or they were medics on the ship or whatever, you know, never mind being in it, you know. So anyways, it was difficult, and but I was able to get through it with the help of people in AA, with some good, you know, care from military medical folks. And that's kind of been the story of my recovery, Howard, is I've made it through difficult things. I've done difficult things in recovery. That first 20 years, I started a very large national nonprofit organization that helps wounded veterans, and ended up being the largest, you know, new nonprofit of the 21st century. I had great success in life and in business, you know, after I got sober, but I thought it was my doing.
Yeah.
You know, and then in 1999, my sister-in-law, I was married to a woman named Julie at the time, and my sister-in-law and my two nephews were going down to look at Christmas lights in San Diego, and they were killed in a car accident. I lost three members of my family in one accident. And my wife at the time, she's not my wife anymore, but she went through an extraordinarily difficult time. And it really, other than the helicopter crash, it's the worst thing that ever happened in my life. And you know, I had to go to San Diego to help that family put the pieces back together. And thank God I had the gifts of this program. I was able to go in and to use what I learned here to love other people and to be of service to other people who were in the most difficult period of their life. You learn those things in AA. I mean, I grew up in this program, you know. I would say I grew up, I learned more, I got more gifts from this than I ever did the military. The military was great for me. But the program, I watched men do those kind of things. Like what you guys did here for John G and his family before he passed. I watched men do those kind of things for other men and other families. I learned those lessons in the rooms of AA.
Yeah, that's an extraordinary set of circumstances that both you and your wife at the time would be going through. It's amazing that you'd stayed sober through that.
I did. I stayed sober through that. And then, you know, again, I was able to build that organization after that. But what happened, Howard, was I got very successful in my own world. I was a bit of a minor celebrity. I did a lot of news, you know, shows. I visited the White House with two presidents. I did a lot of really cool things. I introduced Jimmy Buffett at a concert. I mean, I did some things that were just, you would sit there and pinch yourself and I'd say, I can't believe that a drunk is doing this stuff, right? It's just such a blessing.
Right.
And I helped a ton of people. I poured myself into helping wounded veterans and I didn't pour myself into helping drunks. And so it's different. I was doing service work for other people and I completely dedicated my life to helping wounded veterans and their families.
Right.
But I wasn't doing any AA work. And so when the time came and I was presented with alcohol and my spiritual condition was such that I had that blind spot that they talk about in the Big Book. I think it's Jim that was in Washington in the Big Book.
Yeah.
He had no defense against the first drink. That's what happened to me. I had left my organization, started my own business, was very successful for the first year or two, and then it started to go sideways. And my ego got involved. I saw everything that I had worked for kind of going down the drain, and I was starting to be embarrassed. I lost a big contract. And when my ego got damaged, you know, I had made it through a helicopter crash. I had made it through the loss of family members. I could not make it through the ego hit that I took in losing my business. It just was too much. I had been away from AA for so long. I remember I did go to a meeting that year, and it was like a meditation meeting where they kind of rang the bell. And I'm like, this isn't the answer.
Well, you mentioned earlier that it was about 8 or 9 years in that the unraveling started.
Yeah.
It sounds like the events and the circumstances are not dissimilar from people who go into the helping professions, especially people who become drug counselors or LPCs or whatever else. And because they're working at that, they figure, I've been helping people all day long. That's kind of like what I do in AA. And so you substitute one for the other. I've heard it a million times in the program. AA is not social work. Social work is not AA. AA is not a rehab facility. And you know, all the justifications that people give themselves for why they shouldn't be doing the things that they should be doing.
Yeah.
What were some of the things that you were telling yourself?
I was saying that I was doing good work for the world, that I was helping other people. You know, I had some guys call me on it. And my first sponsor said to me one time, I remember I was sitting in a hotel room in Virginia Beach, you know, and he called me and we talked for probably 45 minutes or an hour. And I called him when I first got sober this time, the second time. And he goes, you know, I talked to you when you were in Virginia Beach that time and you didn't say anything about AA. And he goes, I knew. And maybe he brought it up. Maybe he brought it up that day, but I kind of blew it off. You know, but he said, I didn't hear anything about recovery today, John. You know, you talked a lot about what you were doing and in your life and business and all that kind of stuff, but I didn't hear anything about recovery.
That's usually the clarion call when a guy who has talked about the program over the years and has been showing outwardly the involvement that he's doing in the program doesn't want to hear about it. And I, you know, men who I've lost to slipping, you say, what's going on with regard to your program? Oh, I'm not going to drink, but let me tell you about all these other problems I got. And it's like, wait a second, you know, insanity returns and then we drink. Sounds like that's what happened for you.
Absolutely. There was total insanity. There was no doubt about it. If I were to look back and draw a thread, it was that alcoholic insanity had taken somewhere along the line, had crept back in.
So you stayed dry for the years between the initial unraveling and when you actually took the next drink at 20 years.
Exactly. Yep. I was offered a drink in a I was in a business meeting trying to put my business to, you know, try to save my business. And I had heard earlier in the day that I wasn't going to get the contract. And
that was the straw.
Yeah. I was with some Pakistani businessmen and we were sitting at a table in Georgetown, believe it or not, kind of the same place. I got sobered up and, you know, I usually ask the waiter to take the wine glass away. And when the wine came around, the waiter filled my glass and they toasted and I toasted with them and I drank it. And I remember going home to my house and I said to my now ex-wife, hey, I just want you to know that I had some drinks when I was in Washington and went fine. And I'm gonna drink some more. You know, I think I was just young and immature.
Had she known you while you were drinking?
She did not. She'd never seen me take a drink. So, nor had my children.
Wow. How old were they at the time?
They were 18 and 13.
Okay. So, they were old enough to know what was going on around them.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, things had started to unravel at home as well.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And so, Howard, in pretty short order, like you've heard here a million times, the drinking accelerated. You know, I would pick up a couple of 40s on the way home from work and I would drink two before I got home. So it didn't look like I was having as much when I got to the house. It looked like I was controlling it. And then, you know, she would go to bed and I'd go back out to the refrigerator in the garage and, you know, I'd knock down another six pack before I went to bed.
Did she ask you to quit?
She did. And she stood in front of me and said, I'm scared and crying. I said, it's all going to be okay.
Did anybody ever try to intervene?
Nobody. No.
What do you think? Why do you think nobody intervened or tried to intervene?
Well, it's a great question because I had gotten so outside of the herd that there was no herd. I mean, it's exactly why the lions get you, right? And I had gotten so far outside the herd that there was, other than my sponsor in Virginia, there was nobody to save me. And there was nobody to attempt to.
I call it backing up to the edge of the cliff. The ground feels solid underfoot while you're backing away from the thing that saved you. But by the time your foot hits thin air, it's too late.
The scary thing is, if you had asked me 12 hours before I took that drink, if I would ever drink again, I would have looked you straight in the eye with contempt and said, no, I'll never drink again.
So were you the guy that when AA was brought up during that period of time, when things were unraveling until you actually drank, were you the guy who really didn't want to talk about sobriety or AA?
No. I mean, I think that I was proud that I was still sober. But
you did it yourself, right, at that point?
I mean, people would call me all the time and I would suggest that they go to AA because I was, in my mind, I was sober. You know,
so you had gotten the brass ring.
I was cured.
You were cured.
Absolutely. No doubt about it. I mean, you know, it's funny. I've always been the guy that the military friends, the fraternity friends, when they said, if John can quit, anybody can quit, you ought to call him. And so for years, I got those calls from guys in fraternity or guys in the military.
Even though you weren't participating yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I knew where to send them.
So, you must have had a lot of extra time on your hands then, going from an active AA program to one that you're just staying dry.
No, I had kids.
Well, okay, you had kids, right.
And I had baseball games, and I got very active in business. And I let the things that shouldn't have gotten in the way, you know, and I don't ever remember anybody saying anything you put before your recovery will be the first thing to go. And I put my family before my recovery. I put everything before my
Success, business.
And I lost it all. And so in a period of 16 months, Howard, I lost my marriage. I lost my house. I lost my business. I lost, you know, my children because my ex-wife had moved back to California. Mm-hmm. That takes me here to Houston. I came here on a consulting gig.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
I was living in a garage apartment in Oak Forest. I'd gone from this beautiful home in a golf course community in Florida to this shitty little garage. Mm-hmm. My life had gotten so small. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would get off of my consulting job and I would go to this little microbrewery over in Oak Forest. And, you know, I'd drink till midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning and drown my sorries. Poor me, I'd lost everything. And it was accelerating. And one day I got off of work very early. They cut us loose at like noon. So I went to my favorite place. And all I know is when they gave me my stuff in jail, when they let me out, I had a receipt in my pocket for $140. And that was, I drank $140 worth of beer at a microbrewery between 2 o'clock in the afternoon and, you know, midnight when I left the bar. And I don't remember getting in my car. And I drove over by Rice University. There's a one-way street over there, and I was driving in the wrong way on a one-way street, and I got pulled over by the police. Thank God. Fortunately, I just told the cops right away. He's like, "Have you been drinking?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "We don't have to go through this formality, you know." But we had to. And
I'm so glad you stopped me.
Yeah, it's kind of was one of those things. I didn't even remember driving. The first thing I remember from that entire night is the lights behind me. I knew to pull over instinctively. Yeah. And so I went to jail, and I did what no drunk wants to do. I barfed in the drunk tank, and it was a pretty rough night and, you know, in Houston. It's not a good place to call it the Crossbar Hilton. And I got out about 5 o'clock the next day. Howard, I was so ashamed of myself, like what my life had become. I was at such a low point. And the cop was nice enough. I have two brothers that are FBI agents, and the cop called them, and they arranged bail for me. So I was taken care of when I got out, but I was so ashamed of what I had done. So when I got out, my car was impounded, and I needed to get a taxi. And it's before Uber. Got a taxi. I walked 4 blocks down to, so the taxi driver wouldn't know that I was getting out of jail. And as soon as I got in the car, it's this big African-American guy, huge. I mean, he took up the entire front seat. He drove away, and he looked in the rearview mirror, and he said, "What were you in for?" I told him I was in for a DUI, and I said, "I didn't drink for a long time, and I just thought I was an immature kid and that I could do it again successfully." And he goes, and I can say his name now. Unfortunately, he's passed away, but taxi driver's name was John Drew, and John was an NBA basketball player.
Mm-hmm.
He was a two-time NBA All-Star, and he was the comeback player of the year in 1982. He was actually traded from the Atlanta Hawks for, I can't remember. I'm having trouble remembering the great player for the Hawks. But anyways, he was the first player to ever get the death sentence from David Stern, the NBA commissioner, for cocaine use. He got three strikes and he was out. And he's the first player that the NBA ever gave the lifetime ban to. And so he said, I haven't used drugs in about 10 years. And when we went and stopped and got some cash at an ATM machine, and he pulled up to the impound lot, and I got out of the car, and he, you know, walked up to the window, and he took a card out, and he wrote Post Oak Club on the back, and he said, "You ought to go to this place tomorrow. You look like somebody that belongs there." And so I ended up driving home, and I slept it off, and I remember waking up. God is my witness, Howard. At 6:30 in the morning, I remember waking up to my grandmother's voice saying, "Johnny, it's all going to be okay." And it woke me up like a start, like right out of my sleep. And I was, the night before, I was making the decision, am I going to go hang myself in the shower or am I going to go to an AA meeting? That's what the choices had become. And thank God I went to the Post Oak Club.
So all hope was lost.
All hope was lost. I just didn't see. I was so ashamed. I didn't want to go through the whole taking a chip and being a newcomer. And I honestly wanted to keep drinking.
Yeah.
But I knew it had gotten to the point where I might kill somebody else. And that was too much for me to handle. I couldn't. That's what got me in. That's not what kept me here. But what got me in was I was dangerous to myself and other people.
Mm-hmm.
It was the other people part that got me in the door. It's not what kept me in the door. I did not want my children to have a dad that had killed somebody in a drunk driving accident. I did not want my parents to have to live with that. And I didn't want to live with it myself.
So your life of service kind of manifested in serving the public by taking yourself out of the pool of drunk drivers in the city of Houston.
I guess, yeah. I mean, that's a good way to look at it. But I just knew that I was an unguided missile when I put booze in my body.
So you had this choice between suicide and AA, and you chose wisely, from my perspective. What were the next few days and weeks like going back in?
Yeah, you know, I went to Post Oak, and, you know, there were some guys that were in this meeting here tonight 12 years later that were in my first meeting. The second meeting I went to, of course, which is the most important meeting, right, like a 6 p.m. meeting over at Post Oak, and a group of guys invited me to go to Cafe Express after. Mm-hmm. And it was Boots and Ray and Rod S. And I heard Rod S. tell his story. And you have a wonderful friendship with Rod. And I said, if I'm going to do this, I better do it the right way and get a good sponsor. And so I followed Rod out to his car. And I said, hey, man, would you help me? Would you sponsor me? And you know, he was my sponsor for the next 5 years. And I was so grateful to have him. And, you know, we worked the steps together and we did our fourth and fifth together. And
we talk a lot about if you go back out and drink, you pick up at the point that you would have been at had you never stopped. Looking at getting sober with that same paradigm, at what point did you realize that you had gotten back to AA the way you had left it? I don't mean from after it all unraveled. I mean at the point of your original sobriety when AA was working the best for you, mm-hmm. At what point did you reclaim that mindset and that position the second time around?
You know, it's when I found my crew. And as you know, I met a guy who was really instrumental in my early recovery, a guy named Stan.
Yeah.
I lost my license and
he used to drive you around.
And Stan used to drive me around. He would take me to meetings and, you know, we're still in touch. We're not close like we used to be as far as seeing each other all the time. But I know for a fact that God put him in my life and I would not be sober today without him. And he's sober today. He celebrated 12 years in December. And so I love Stan. I love Rod. I love the guys. But I got a crew and I ran with that crew hard and, you know, I probably did 180 meetings and in 90 days. I did all the things that I knew I didn't do the first time. And, you know, it was really hard to hear guys that were 30 days sober tell me to keep coming back. And, you know, it ate my ego. And oftentimes in meetings, I would close my eyes and say, breathe, you need to be humble. You need to be humble. You need to be humble. You need to be teachable. It did not work the first time. You need to listen for why it didn't work the first time. And it took me a long time to figure that out. And frankly, I came out of a meeting at Delta probably 4 or 5 years sober. And I was telling part of my story. And I said that I chose to take a drink after 20 years. And Kevin C., who's my sponsor today, came up to me after the meeting and said, dude, you had no choice. You don't understand the program if you think you had a choice.
Yeah.
Because if we had a choice, we wouldn't need AA.
What you were saying is the program stopped working for me when in reality you had stopped working for the program.
That's exactly right. I mean, 5 years in, 25 years into kind of coming around AA,
mm-hmm.
And that's when I had my aha moment. That was one of the things. And then the second thing was the insanity that they talk about in the second step is the insanity that we could drink again. That's what they're talking about. It is a condition of the mind, but the insanity is the idea that somehow, someday, I will enjoy and control my drinking again.
Yeah.
The great obsession. That's the insanity that they talk about in the second step. And that was another huge revelation for me, having worked the steps
yeah.
a bunch of times. It's just more will be revealed. It's like peeling back the onion. And the other thing that's been helpful in my recovery this time is I married a woman in the program. I did not meet her in the program.
Mm-hmm.
I met her on Match.com. She said her two favorite books were The Bible and The Big Book. And I reached out to her, you know, we had an email thing going for a couple of weeks and then she disappeared. And I ended up dating somebody else for a while. And about a year later, she reappeared. And I said, "Hey, Lisa," I said, "hadn't seen you in a long time. You kind of disappeared on me." And when we got together, she had just gotten sober. And her sponsor said, "Uh-uh, no relationships in the first year." And so she went off the radar. And, you know, we ended up dating. And we've been married now for 5 years. And it's...
Congratulations on that.
Yeah, it's great. It's a totally different dynamic being married to somebody in recovery.
Do you do meetings together or do you keep your programs mutually exclusive?
Yeah, I think the first time that I told her she shared a little bit too long, that was our last meeting together.
So, yeah, you got to stay out of your partner's, out of their program. I learned that the hard way when my wife would go to Al-Anon. It almost made me feel like I had a special dispensation to tell her now that we were both on the same sheet of music, and that never worked out. So you each work your own programs.
We do. And a friend of ours who we both really like said, the program is 12 steps. It's not 14 or 24. It's 12 steps. You have 12 and she has 12. And we've kind of lived by that.
And they're the same 12.
They're the same 12. And I'm not to get into her 12 and she's not to get into my 12.
Right. And about the only thing you can say is, I support you in going to meetings. And I can never quite stay away from giving somebody who I see is struggling some advice, like go to more meetings. I would rather be the guy who's annoying the guy who doesn't want to go than to be finding out later that had I said something, it might have made a difference. So I would rather err on the side of saying too much. But when it comes to a spouse in either the same program or another 12-step program, I think it's one of the most insidious ways to show judgmentalism about your spouse is to presume that you know the type of program that she should be working.
No doubt. And I'm very fortunate. I have an incredibly... You know, when you're married to somebody who understands what kind of drunk you were,
right?
They encourage you to go to as many meetings as you feel you need.
Well, hence you being able to be here on such short notice. I saw you this morning at the meeting. I asked you if I could interview you tonight. Here you are. So somewhere along the way, you told Lisa about this, and she said, by all means, and here you are, and here we are, and... You know, your story is remarkable in so many different ways. And I knew it was a remarkable story back when I first saw you come back after the 2-year hiatus. And you came and you walked into this very room. And I remember seeing Stan with you, and you guys were like joined at the hip for a while there. But he's just a really good man. I still see him from time to time whenever he's over at the club. But The story that you told is one that I think needs to be told, and it's not told enough, and that is you can get too important. You can get too rich for AA. You can get, not for AA so much as for sobriety. You know, you can be too successful for sobriety. And you can never not get the gifts of the program, and the promises will never fail to materialize as long as we work for them.
That's right.
So somewhere along the way, you stopped the work.
I did.
But you were able to survive. You didn't hang yourself, in other words. You survived to get back. A lot of people don't. Have you ever given thought to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's only God. Yeah. You know, that God put my grandmother's voice in my head at 6:30 in the morning on the...
Well, is she deceased?
She is deceased. She had been deceased a long time, and I hadn't heard her voice.
Wow.
Until that morning. And I know that sounds... crazy to some people, but I know her voice is clear as day. And she said, "It's all going to be okay, Johnny." And I, as God is my witness, I shot out of bed like a shot. And I knew it was going to be okay. And then the one other thing I'd say, my daughters have been remarkable. I have two wonderful kids. They've forgiven me, and I did my, made my amends to them. And my daughter at the time, you know, she said, "Dad, just promise me you'll never drink again." And it was incredible. I didn't think I had done that much damage in 18 months, Howard, but I had done enough that my children said, Dad, please don't ever drink again. And I made a promise to my children that there's plenty of guys that have made promises to their kid that they would never drink again, right? But I meant it. All that being said, there's times where I haven't made enough meetings. There's times where in this period of sobriety where I haven't done enough work, where I haven't been involved enough, where I got too busy, where I got outside of the mothership and got too far away. Yeah. I'm a guy who can isolate very, very quickly.
I think we all can. I think that's what that alcoholism is, a disease of isolation. You know, we don't want to be around people when we know that we're doing something that we know and they know is violating our morals or our standards or our commitment or our spiritual life. We don't, the shame is just overwhelming in those situations, isn't it?
I agree with that. I also want to add that I've never wanted to be a burden to other people. And there's part of me, I've shared with you in the past that I've struggled with depression and with PTSD. And one of the things that I learned is when I don't want to reach out is when I have to reach out right away, because the depression gets worse when I isolate. And I've learned, because through the hard times, I've called men in this program who listened to me when I thought I was whiny. They said, that's not whining. That's life. And that's why we help each other. You know, I wasn't whining about, you know, traffic or something like that. I had a problem that I didn't want to put on another man. So I took it internally. And this program is about, the fellowship is so incredible for that. That's been the biggest help in with my difficulties with depression, or is just calling another man when I don't want to.
Yeah. And it's acknowledging the power of that disease too, because the diseases of depression and anxiety and alcoholism, they kind of operate on their own power and on their own inertia. You know, the way I can tell when I'm depressed, one of the ways that I've learned over the years, is if I'm sitting in an AA meeting and people are saying stuff that I normally would be laughing at, and I find that I'm not laughing, it's like a little nudge in the ribs to me to say, check the depression. Check how you're feeling today about just being alive. Depression, if alcoholism is a disease that tells us we don't have a disease, then to me, depression is a disease that says, who cares? You're not worth anything anyway, or whatever the lies that the disease of depression tells us. So I've always, over the years, been very strong on letting people know that I have been treated medically and therapeutically for a long, long time. And the depression, I don't think it ever totally goes away, but it's a manageable thing. It's like the alcoholism never really goes away, but it's a manageable thing. But the management of that particular disease, some days it can be very, very difficult because you just don't want to get out of bed. Well, that has nothing to do with the fact that you're still sober or that you're going to go to a meeting in a half hour.
It is, Howard, and has the same, just like we have tools in recovery, there's tools in treating depression. You know, I know that I need to get out and move. Mm-hmm. I need to get outside and I need to move. It's as effective as any SSRI or anything else. There's things that I know to do today. The other thing is I've got to look at anger, because I believe, I've heard it said, and I believe that depression is oftentimes anger turned inward. And it's often anger at ourselves, that we've disappointed ourselves, self-hatred. And so I have to look at those things as well. And sometimes that's where the two programs connect and where God is the only answer.
And I agree with that so much. You know, you and I are on the right path when it comes to our understanding of and the mutual respect for the diseases and how they can work in tandem.
Well, we've lost guys, we've lost friends in this program who killed themselves sober, who were going to meetings, and the depression's what killed them. And we know of them. I mean, I know we know several of them that, you know, the week before we saw them here and the next week they were dead.
That's a tough thing to see happen. But, you know, the fact that you're here talking about and really being open and very candid with your story, I think is just amazing. And I love the fact that you've taken the time and invested your heart in allowing me to better understand you, John, as a person, but also what you're dealing with your alcoholism, depression, and just living life. And my hope and prayer is that as people listen to this podcast, someone, even if one person, one place in the entire planet is helped by it, all this is worthwhile. They hear 5 minutes of people's story in a meeting. The men who heard your share tonight heard 5 minutes of your story. But when they can hear the whole thing, either at a speaker meeting or, let's say, in this format, they can put that 5 minutes into the right context. You know, I get why he's saying that, because it seems to me I remember him saying this, that, and the other thing. So my hope is that that will also aid people in getting to know you a little bit better and allowing you to feel that much more comfortable with letting them into your life. You won't be able to keep them out at this
point. Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity. You know, I've only told my story in all these years. This is the only the second time that I've ever told my story.
Well, you honor me with that. To me, that is a mutual blessing for both of us to be able to be. And here we are in the beautiful retreat center and a very spiritual place for me for the past 36 years of my sobriety. And we're sitting here and we're having this frank, heart-to-heart, knee-to-knee discussion about the important things in life, you know, family, friends, a spiritual connection, and everything else is kind of secondary as long as we stay sober.
Yeah, it definitely is. You know, I would be remiss if I didn't say that I've believed in God for my whole life. I just tried to hide from him for a long time.
It's hard to do, isn't it?
It is, and I know he's been with me the entire time. I have to work very diligently to make sure that other people know that this is not of my doing. This is of God's doing, because the first time I thought it was of my doing. If I get unplugged from my source, I'm heading for disaster. And so I just want to acknowledge that, you know, God has been an incredibly important part of my entire journey this time in recovery.
And he's put the two of us together right here to explore some really important things for both of us. Well, I want to thank you for doing this, John. I love you as a brother and a friend.
Love you, Howard.
God bless. Thanks.
Thanks, Howard. God bless.
Well, my friends, that's it for today's episode of AA Recovery Interviews. I want to thank my guest, John M., for sharing his story, and thank you for tuning in. If you've enjoyed the interviews in this podcast series, please share it with others. This show is another helping hand of AA we can extend to alcoholics everywhere. If you want to contact me directly with any comments, questions, or suggestions, simply email howard@aarecoveryinterviews.com. Please also take a minute to leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. By the way, this podcast strictly adheres to AA's 12 traditions and all General Service Office guidelines for safeguarding anonymity online. AA Recovery Interviews and my guests do not speak for or represent AA at large. This podcast is simply my way of giving back to AA that which has been so freely given to me. The next episode of AA Recovery Interviews is on the way, so keep coming back. It'll be here soon.